Some of you might recognize Mozart, but did you know that's the phrase that started a beautiful relationship between the composer and a starling? As Mozart wrote in his notebook, one day he came across the bird in a shop, whistling the theme from the Allegretto to his Piano Concerto No. 17 in G major, which Mozart had just written and barely performed. How could the bird know it? Mozart jotted down his own version and the starling's, which, except for a sharp or two, was the same. Mozart's comment, "Das war schön, that was wonderful," as he bought the bird and brought it home. Okay, that's one version of the story, and we're sticking with it. Author and naturalist Lyanda Lynn Haupt goes much further. She took in a starling, named it Carmen, named Mozart's star, and tried to answer the question, how could this most beloved of composers have found a muse in one of the most reviled of birds? Ever since they were brought here from England in the late 1800s for a stunt, people have tried to kill starlings. They've so multiplied. The book is Mozart's Starling. Lyanda joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Hi.
Hi, Robin.
What a great idea and a great read, although when your husband is balanced on a ladder precariously trying to take this little bird from a nest, it might not have seemed like a good idea. But start with, we've spoken about this on the program, why are starlings so reviled?
They are a non-native and invasive species, and they are smart, they're adaptable, they're clever, they're robust, they're aggressive, and so they've been able to take over just about every place that they attempt.
Well, they eat animal feed, they kick other birds out of nesting places. They're considered a pest, more than a pest.
Exactly. They are considered more than a pest. People look out their windows and see them behaving badly to the nicer little birds in their neighborhood. And so even people who don't know the science or the agricultural end of it know enough about starlings to hate them.
But they also can mimic like a parrot, as you
Yes.
found out. So first of all, Mozart's starling. This bird went on and became such a companion, such a delight to Mozart, which isn't unusual back in the day. People carried their birds around in cages like boomboxes.
Yeah, they did. People had little tiny cages in their houses, not usually starlings, maybe a more melodious bird like a canary. They would carry it around and it would be the radio in the house.
Oh, just a lovely image. So you bring Carmen in to your home. First of all, you're a birder, you're an ornithologist. I mean, you know your birds. But this little furry ball, as it starts to grow, what was happening with your relationship with Carmen?
One of the things I didn't realize when we adopted Carmen is how friendly she would be. She just wants to be with us all the time. So we allow her as much free flight as she can possibly have and still be safe. And when she's out of her aviary, she just doesn't want to be with us. She wants to be on our shoulder, on our head, sharing our plates, sharing our beverages. You know, she just wants to be involved in everything. So the writing of this book literally took twice as long as it would have because it was written with her on my shoulder.
Well, because she's a social being, but she's also, as you write, starlings are, you know, one of the few birds that is a mimic. And first of all, she's talking, chatting all the time. Let's listen to a little of Carmen vocalizing.
The first vocalization you heard there was her saying her name, "Hi, Carmen."
Wait, let's hear it again.
Okay, let's hear it again.
Because she's mimicking what you had your family said to her.
Right. So that's the most amazing thing. So the first word that she learned to say was hi, and the second word was honey and Carmen, the second and third words. She says hi, honey, and hi, Carmen, because that's the first thing we say to her when we approach her aviary. Mm. One of the things that has been most surprising is that her mimicry is not random. When I come down in the morning, I tiptoe down, I'm the first one up, and I walk up to her cage. She doesn't meow like the cat, or she doesn't make the coffee grinder noise or the microwave beep, which are all things that she's capable of doing very well. The first thing she says is what she knows I'm about to say, which is, "Hi, Carmen." And I say, "Hi, Carmen." And then the cat comes downstairs, and when Carmen sees the cat, she says, "Meow."
Actually, I think we have some of that sound. Let's listen. So she knows who makes which sound.
She knows who makes which sound and when they're going to make it.
Well, look, okay. So here you're on this journey of discovery with this little feathered thing. We know that Mozart had a bird. What does it tell you about what that relationship might have been?
Finding out that they are so participatory in the household made me think of someone like Mozart, who was an expert himself at mimicry. He could mimic any operatic style. He liked to do mimics of other people at parties. He would mimic the emperor for fun. And he could imitate in his writing any musical style. So he had to have so much fun having a bird that was almost as gifted a mimic as he was in the house, or vice versa.
Well, you write both were incapable of being still and quiet in a world so full of sound. We know that about Mozart.
Right.
Both share the impulse to make wild, original, constant music. And I want to hear one piece of Mozart's music, because you think that it actually might have been influenced more by his bird than people realize. It is Mozart's musical joke. Let's just listen to a little. It's performed by Gunther Schuller and the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Now, some people turn up their noses at this piece. It's like, it's crazy, it's wacky. You say what?
In 1990, an ethologist, Meredith West at Indiana, an animal behavior researcher, she had heard about Mozart's Starling. And she listened to this piece of Mozart and thought, oh my gosh, I don't think it's that crazy. I think it sounds a lot like a starling. This piece was mimicking back the fractured phrases that starlings make when they vocalize, the way that they will just pick out little bits of things here and there and toss them in unexpectedly alongside different vocalizations that they don't seem to go very well with to our ear, but they must like for some reason.
Well, and that makes perfect sense to me, because as you tell us, Mozart didn't even attend his own father's funeral when his father died. But 2 months later, when his starling died, he held a funeral and wrote an elegy. He was broken up as anyone. I mean, now that you've had this living creature on your head, you understand that.
Absolutely. Commentators on Mozart, when they hear just the little bit that, you know, Mozart didn't attend his father's funeral, but he had this elegant formal funeral when his starling died, they say that it was just, you know, a joke, that it was just his eccentricity or absurdity. When I read that, the only thing I can think is, having lived with a starling, I know that there was more to it for Mozart than that. He was brokenhearted at the loss of his little mischievous friend and pet, especially so soon after the loss of his father. And surely this funeral did appeal to Mozart's sense of the absurd. I think it also might have relieved some of the conflict that he felt in not being able to attend his father's funeral in Salzburg.
Well, and he also might have been influenced elsewhere in his work. The Birdcatcher from Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute, may have been inspired by a starling. Let's just listen to a little of The Magic Flute, where you can hear bird-like sounds. Landolin Haupt, there's so much more here. If someone decides to take in a starling, it's a lot of work. They need baths every day. They take sun baths as well, where they fall into a torpor-like state. But after all of this and all the time you spent realizing that Mozart's starling was a muse, Carmen, your starling, does not really like, well, what does she like, bluegrass?
This is such a disappointment. She doesn't like Mozart at all. And she comes to life when other music is playing. She loves Bach. She loves bluegrass. And when we were playing her favorite band, Green Sky Bluegrass, actually, she just perks up as she starts singing and she starts chattering. And she gives her happy singing sounds.
Let's listen to a little of her singing with some bluegrass. Carmen, rocking out. Which brings us to why birds sing. You spend a lot of time, I mean, this book goes to Noam Chomsky and, you know, several PhDs who have tried to answer that question. It ranges from as a mating call to pure bliss. Talk about just this sense that you have of this universal sound that is this orchestra that's right outside our doors and we often don't notice it.
What I've seen living with Carmen and paying much more attention to all of the sounds in nature is that it's far more deep, far more participatory than we can reduce to just having to do with mating. And one of the ways I know that is that Carmen, as a songbird, she's not really supposed to be that vocal as a female. But Carmen, as a female, sings a lot, and she sings year-round. And I write in the book that when I was coming to the end, I had my writing studio window open just a little bit because Carmen was there and I didn't want her to get out. And I was listening to Mozart, and outside there's an orange-crowned warbler singing. And I thought, who am I to decide which one of these is music and which one isn't?
Or in other words, it may not be that the starling heard Mozart's theme, but the composers are, subconsciously or not, hearing birds. It's the birds who are providing the music, not the other way around. That's Leandelin Haupt. She writes about Mozart's pet starling and her own, Carmen, in the new book, Mozart's Starling. It is just wonderful. Leanda, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Oh, and Leanda says, don't try this at home. Yes, starlings are an invasive species, but keeping one is illegal in most states.